Hey guys, this is Rocky Suppinger. You're listening to the Yo Rocco podcast. We now have our own theme music to introduce the podcast, with many thanks to Landon Witsit, also known musically as Go to Sleep John Darling. Landon was the guest on episode 2 of the Yo Rocco podcast, so I encourage you to go listen to that and hear him talk about that project. My guest today was Brian Ellison. Brian is the executive director of the Covenant Network of Presbyterians, which is an organization that's working within the Presbyterian Church USA for the full inclusion of LGBTQ persons in the life of the church. And he's really great at what he does. But he also works in public radio. And that was what I was really interested in talking to him about. So we had a great conversation. We got into a lot of the aspects of public radio work and what you have to do to be good at it. And at the end, as a special bonus, Brian was kind enough to record an introduction, a vocal introduction to the podcast. So not only do we have a new musical introduction, but we have a vocal introduction as well. So enjoy the podcast. Here's my conversation with Brian.
This is Brian Ellison of KCUR and the Covenant Network of Presbyterians. You're listening to the Yo Rocco podcast with Rocky Suppinger. Stay tuned.
As a way of starting, I would just love for people to know where you were yesterday.
Yesterday, I was at the Kansas City Royals season opener versus the Chicago White Sox at Kauffman Stadium. It was the 15th home opener that I've attended. I missed only one in the 16 years I have lived here in Kansas City.
And how did it rank among those 15?
It was a pretty great game. The second most runs ever scored at a home opener by the Kansas City Royals, 10 runs against the White Sox, who scored one run. I was in the press box.
There it is.
So that wasn't bad either. Although, I got to say, sitting in the press box is not... Well, it's a great way to watch a game. I'm not complaining, but it's very different than being out with real people.
So you texted me at one point during the game that you had just cheered in the press box, and that was embarrassing.
Right, it is, because you get dirty looks. You are absolutely not allowed to cheer in the press box. It's working press, and they're all business up there. It's very quiet, which is strange when the stadium is exploding in cheers to just sort of sit there.
Are people trying to restrain themselves? Do you see the instinct or the impulse in people to cheer?
No, just in me, I guess. Maybe they're all the seasoned professionals, and I'm sort of a pretender in that space. This is a once a year occasion. The public radio station that I work with broadcasts live on opening day their morning talk show, and so we need press passes to get into the stadium, and then we just sort of hang around the rest of the day. So that's why we were there.
So you did a broadcast before the game started?
We did. I was actually not on the air on this day, but by virtue of my longstanding commitment to this program, and also by the 3 caramel macchiatos I bought the producer the week before, my name was on the credential list to be part of the team.
These are the secrets to broadcasting success.
Right. And frankly, caramel macchiatos, they're $4 or $5, but... opening day tickets were selling for $120 on StubHub, so really pretty good investment.
So you didn't even have to buy a ticket. You just got to go in with your press pass, and then was there a seat for you outside the press box?
No, there was not. And so we were free to leave, and I did wander around the stadium, took in the atmosphere a little bit, but no, there was really nowhere to sit except in the press box. In fact, they were selling standing room tickets for $120. Seats would have cost even more than that.
My gosh. Well, was it last year on opening day that you actually were on the air before the game, right?
Yeah, well, it was the same program. I was, again, not hosting that day, but I was kind of managing social media for the broadcast that day. And you could hear me in the background at one point because one of our guests, who was the seamstress for the Kansas City Royals, I mean, who knew? They all The teams have a seamstress to.
This is what public radio covers about sports. The seamstress.
Yeah. Right. Well, we had the guy who chooses the players' walk-up music or who plays it. We had the guy who runs the Royals Hall of Fame out in the outfield. But yeah, the seamstress was the star of the show, as far as I was concerned. She has to, you know, put all their names on the jerseys, sometimes with just a few hours' notice if they call someone up, you know, before the game. And she makes repairs to uniforms for both teams. When they're in town, she stole the show when the host asked her, how well do you really get to know the players? And she said, well, Steve, you know, I have my hands in their pants all the time.
Wow.
Yeah, that was pretty good.
That's kind of a career defining moment when you get to say that on public radio.
I mean, maybe she uses that joke all the time, but it seemed very natural. It was a great moment. Yeah.
Yeah. So she's probably used it a bunch.
So you could hear me because I uproariously laughed. It was just clearly audible in the replay of the show if you want to check it out.
So I could check it out. Your broadcast stuff is online, right?
It is. KCUR has a really good archive, especially of their talk shows, as well as their news reports, and they tag us all with our pieces, our bylines for each piece. So those who are absurdly and ridiculously interested could go to kcur.org and search for my name, and you can find work I've done there.
I think you just described the public radio audience in general, absurdly interested.
In the people who are on the air, that is true. Right. Although I really don't have the name for it, you know, I'm not Ophavia Quistarkton, Dakar,
Sylvia Poggioli.
Right, I'm just Brian Ellison, whatever.
Well, I mean, come on, there's a Scott Simon. That's not...
Even that has alliteration. It's not, Brian Ellison. I mean, that's nothing, really. But, yeah. But I hear what you're saying. It doesn't have to be... it doesn't have to represent some other culture or something.
I'm just impressed, and have been ever since you started doing this, with the fact that you're actually on the air. I mean, we are in the same vocation, you and I, and yet you have this whole other thing that you've been doing for, what, 7-8 years now?
Yeah.
I mean, I know because I was there, but describe how that even started. Like, how did you come to be on the staff of the local public radio station in Kansas City?
So journalism is really what I thought I was going to do before I felt called to ministry. In college, I would spend, you know, whatever, 60, 70 hours a week at the college paper, and that was totally the life I thought I was preparing for. Felt the call, went to seminary. Most of my friends are now, you know, big-time journalists, my college friends. But I got away from that, but still missed it. And, of course, like every other pastor I know, was a regular listener to NPR, supported my it's my main source of sermon illustrations.
Right. We should say you are a Presbyterian.
Well, okay. That would not
be true of all pastors.
Fair enough. But, you know, I listened all the time and gave them occasional money and eventually was volunteering with one of their fund drives where they let people from the community go on the air and ask for money. So I was occasionally on the air, during Pledge Week. When I was there for one of these, I met the producer of one of the daily talk shows and suggested this idea that had been bouncing around in my head, that they don't cover religion very much. Most public radio covers it only on rare occasion. And I suggested that a good idea for a talk show would be to have something that I tentatively called a religion roundtable, where we brought in clergy of different faiths, or certainly different traditions, and think up some topic. I would be glad to coordinate it, I said. I'll find some clergy. I'll outline a possible show. Basically, what I didn't know it was called then, I would produce the show and be one of the panelists, and we could see how it worked. And the producer said, okay, we'll give it a shot. And
I'm sure that's exactly what you expected.
Well, and it didn't happen right away, I should say. They had me as a guest on, I think they had a topic one year of, like, what are you preaching on Christmas Eve? They asked, like, 4 or 5 pastors to talk about that. And I was on the air, so they at least got to hear me sound like I could carry on a conversation, at least. And so they gave it a shot. It went well. We did it again a month later. It went well. And then the next time, the host couldn't be there that day, and they asked if I would be willing to guest host the show for one of these religion roundtables. And I agreed to do that, and it went pretty well. I also started sort of volunteering at the station. I guess it was basically an internship, but I was the world's oldest intern in that case. So I.
How old were you at the time?
Oh, I did 32 or something. No, probably, yeah, well, 35, somewhere in there. Okay. So I was volunteering. I was learning a little bit of how to do the off-air stuff, edit sound together, and put together promos and billboards. That's the 1 minute long introduction to a show that plays at the top of the hour before the news.
You must have just loved doing it, right?
Right, and I was doing it on my day off, but I didn't have a lot else to do, and it was good to be doing something for fun. So I learned how to do that. Eventually, they asked me to fill in for a producer who went on paternity leave for a few months. The church graciously agreed. The church I was pastor of agreed to let me spend that time doing that work, like quarter time, in addition to the work I was doing at the church. It was fun. I enjoyed it. I got to know the station. I got to do a little more guest hosting, and now I'm pretty much the regular substitute host when any of their daily talk show hosts are gone.
And how often is that?
Oh, I probably host on average a few times a month. It depends on the month. Sometimes I'll do a whole week when someone's on vacation, and sometimes I'll go a month or two without doing it.
I'm curious about the church. I mean, you were the pastor of a church for 12 years?
Yeah, 13 almost.
Yeah. And they gave you permission to take this little quarter time thing at the radio station, but did they really embrace it? Was it something that people at the congregation were really excited about, or was there some resistance?
I think for the most part they embraced it. If they were resistant, they didn't tell me, which is entirely possible. I think most people really appreciated it. I think they thought it was cool to hear their pastor on the radio, and these are mostly NPR listening types of folks, so they appreciated that was a good thing to be doing. And the truth is, Rocky, I think I was a better pastor because I was doing this. Like,
Why?
I loved kind of getting out into the real world, a whole different community, a whole different crowd of people than the church. I mean, I think it exposed me to different ideas. I was having to speak a language other than churchese to a whole different group of people, and I think that was good for me. I think it made me a better preacher and a better communicator, and I think it was mutually beneficial.
But that must have been kind of a jarring adjustment at first, right? Like, did you use the word hermeneutic in a production meeting or something?
No, I did not. Although that would be a good concept for journalists to recognize that they are bringing a particular perspective to their work. That would be an excellent illustration. I will use that at the next news meeting. Thank you for mentioning that.
What I'm getting at is, like, did it happen in a way that surprised you that oh, I'm using language from a church context that I'm used to, and that just doesn't work here?
Yeah, every once in a while, and I'll do that on the air. I'll even do that to this day sometimes, where I'll have to say as we say in the church business. But I do acknowledge on the air, especially if it is a religious topic or something that overlaps with my work, with the Covenant Network now. Yeah, I acknowledge on the air pretty regularly that I'm a Presbyterian minister. In a way, I think that's also good for the station. I dare say that defies the stereotype of public radio journalist,
right,
a little bit. And I think it's good for the station to be able to say they have a diverse set of backgrounds and perspectives represented in those who fill their airwaves.
But has your job as a Presbyterian minister ever been a subject among, like, the audience? Has the station ever heard from any of its listeners about that?
I know that the Religion Roundtable show occasionally gets, a negative response from people who don't think there should be religion on public radio.
You mean the godless secularists that are NPR's audience?
Right. That we like to hang out with, at least when we're listening to the radio.
Right.
Yes, occasionally that happens, but I think the opposite is probably more common. I mean, I think people genuinely appreciate hearing a religious voice that is not does not fulfill a stereotype of being reactionary or wacky. And I think that's especially true when it comes to the radio. To be Christian on the radio conveys a whole set of assumptions and a particular sound. And so to be religious on the radio and not be Christian radio is, I think, actually a pretty good niche.
Is that what you set out to do?
No, it's not really. I mean, I set out to be a good journalist when I'm on the air, to ask good questions. I mean, usually I'm not talking about religion these days when I'm on the air. I'm talking about politics or some author's new book or social issues in the community, whatever the topic happens to be. And as a substitute host, it really is whatever the topic happens to be.
You don't have any choice.
Often I don't.
What's the worst topic you've ever been given to lead a conversation on the radio?
The worst topic?
What's or the most difficult? The most difficult for you, where you saw it and you were like, oh, man.
Well, this is probably embarrassing enough, but I did have to host what at the time was a regular monthly or maybe every 3 months kind of program that one of the shows did, which was a women's health show, where they had an obstetrician, gynecologist, answer questions. I've generally not said the word vagina on the air, but I did 3 times during that show.
Well, let me just say, you should be, it may disappoint you to know that you're not the first person to say it on my podcast.
No, well, and really, I think you should maybe have all of your guests say it, just as you can kind of weave those together.
Not going to do that.
No? All right.
Marcy Glass used it first, so she has that over you.
I'm not surprised by that, actually.
So you had to host this monthly conversation with an OBGYN.
I did on one occasion, and that was the one that intimidated me most beforehand. But I was told that I sounded perfectly natural using the word vagina. So,
did you take that as a compliment?
I don't know what that means. I find that troubling, actually, because I think in any other setting I would not seem very natural using that word.
Why is that?
Oh, nothing. Let's move on.
All right. yes. So the aspect of this of being a religious figure on public radio, like. You said it made you a better pastor, and that's not something you had in mind when you first started to do it. You just started to do it because journalism is one of the things that you've always loved to do, and this is a really great opportunity to do it. Like, what's one or two things that you learned that were really, really valuable for just for being a pastor, like, right away in doing this work at a radio station?
Well, I think part of it was sort of having a semi-real job, which most of us who are pastors don't have. People, the realities of a workplace, which is true of most of our parishioners, but not true of most pastors, other than the very specific contours of a church, which is a workplace, but with a very different dynamic usually. I think it also, though, was really good for me to just get exposed to something new. I had to sort of throw myself into a new topic every day that I was hosting a show. I had to learn something about it. I had to figure out what was important about it. I had to sound intelligent talking about it. I had to be able to ask good questions about it. I mean, remember, what I do there is host a talk show most of the time, so it's not really about me. It's about someone else, about sort of mining their intelligence and their experience for what is interesting and important to another community of listeners. And I think that's a pretty good skill for a pastor to have, figuring out how to ask good questions, how to cultivate a meaningful conversation, not just a conversation. And I mean, I feel like that was good. And I guess the other benefit that it was just plain evangelism. I can't tell you, I know it's public radio, and I know that's not the biggest listening audience in the world, but I can't tell you how many people I run into in the community who say, oh, you're that Brian Ellison. You're the one I hear on KCUR. And that happened at the church, too. I mean, people came and said, we heard your pastor on the radio. that was good evangelism in some sense.
The public radio audience is a mission field.
Well, it is. I mean, what are the mission fields today, right? It's if there's a group of people that are informed and educated, but also skeptical of religion, that's probably a pretty good mission field to name. I need to clarify. I don't want anyone to hear this who might be in that category, or for that matter, my bosses at the station, and think that I'm doing this as evangelism. I think that's a side benefit from the perspective of faith.
But covert motive has been laid bare.
Yes, and that's why I've been secretly whispering the word Jesus every 60 seconds on the air. No, but I think. You know, you don't have to be set out intentionally to evangelize to have a positive impact. And this is a place where I think just doing the job of journalism or hosting a radio show well is the best impact we can have.
So when I was talking to Eric Clark a couple weeks ago about his YouTube channel that he started, he said that the internet is his audience. You have a broadcast radio audience. In an era where at least the dominant story is that is taking the audience away, like the internet is taking the audience away from old broadcast channels. Are you seeing that? Like, how does that affect your work?
Well, yeah, of course. But to make no mistake, the internet is our radio audience as well. I mean, we have hundreds and hundreds of people who listen to the program on podcasts rather than live on the air. The talk shows air at 10 a.m. and 11 a.m., so a lot of people are working but still listen to the program when they have time. So on a certain level, it's the same. But I do think that's true. I think that radio has had to find ways to maintain its audience and see what it can offer that the internet can't, or at least podcasting alone. I think the geographic element is really important. You know, the public radio station serves its community. You know, you can have a Kansas City metro area podcast, but there's something about a radio station where the tower stands in the middle of the people who it is targeted at.
Yeah.
And there's something very lively about knowing that we're handling issues that affect very directly the people who can hear us talking about it.
And there's a legacy with broadcast media and broadcast radio in particular that you're actually a part of things that are happening in real time and can have a very concrete effect on those things, like in the minutes and hours in which they're unfolding, right?
Sure. I mean, I think that's especially true for our news staff. But yes, absolutely. And you shape public opinion. You know, podcasting can do that, but I think part of what's appealing to me about podcasting is that you do it on your schedule. You can take the time to reflect. People listen to it on their schedule, possibly days or weeks or years after you record it. Public radio is happening right now. And, you know, I do think even with recent events, take Ferguson last year. You know, right. the work that St. Louis Public Radio was doing to cover that was truly excellent, which, you know, you can listen to that on the internet, but really it was the people who live in St. Louis who were primarily benefiting from it.
Right.
But it was amazing. It was coverage that you were really not going to get anywhere else, and being in that moment really mattered.
And you were listening to it in Kansas City?
I listened to some of it. You know, when some of those nights of riots were breaking out, and you could get a sense of it on Twitter. Eventually, CNN was there with their cameras, but even that tended toward the sensational. It was, you know, reporters who really knew the space, like the public radio reporters in St. Louis, who were using social media to cover it as well. But they were on the air a lot of those nights, and it was pretty compelling.
Interesting. So you have a Twitter account. Do you use Twitter in concert with your public radio gigs?
I do. I use it particularly to promote when I'm going to be on the air, since nobody knows. And I do occasionally ask for input on things through Twitter. You know, all of our programs have Twitter handles themselves, and people submit questions for the broadcasts while they're on the air that way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I must have the strangest group of Twitter followers ever. I've got people who follow me because of the radio station. I've got people who follow me from the national life of the Presbyterian Church. I've got the Kansas City LGBT community. There's all these weird overlapping, intersecting communities that must read lots of my tweets and say, well, why is he talking about that?
That's pretty critical, though, don't you think? I mean, like, that's that whole thing, again, about being in two different contexts at the same time or more.
Yeah, well, that's right, I guess. I just don't know what effect that has on people. I mean,
It's Twitter. It probably has no effect.
You know, do the people who followed me on... because I'm a host of a public radio show, care about my 6-tweet-long rant about some Presbyterian polity fiasco at General Assembly? I doubt it, but they may find it interesting.
Yeah, or you can do like I do on Twitter, which is just kind of tune most things out. Like, I mean, my Twitter feed is a mess of different things that I thought were interesting at one given moment, and like, you know, I've turned all the notifications off on Twitter, so I just go like dip my toe in the river for yeah. like 2 minutes, and then I'm like, I can't handle this.
Me too. I mean, if I had been more on top of it when I first started following people, you know, I could have made lists and categories and sort of brought some sense to my Twitter usage, but instead I follow 900 people with no sense of priority over what I want to read at any time.
So. No, see, I did that. I did the lists, and I used the different Twitter clients that allowed you to show several columns at once with different lists and different people, and that just was so much work. I just quit doing it. I was like, I'm just gonna open the app on my phone every now and again whenever I want to, and I'm going to see what's happening wherever, and that's going to be how I do it. And, you know, where I found it useful, and you'll appreciate this from a journalistic standpoint, is when there's something happening important in the world and I don't know anything about it, the people, the journalists who are using Twitter to report about it are, you follow those people, like, right now. And
right.
For the next several days, as that thing happens, you check your Twitter feed and see what those people are writing. Like, when things really blew up in Syria, I can't remember who published it, but it was like Slate or somebody who published this article about 10 Twitter accounts to follow to understand what's happening in Syria, and I followed all of them, and I've since dropped them out of my feed because I feel like it accomplished what I needed it to, like to let me know the basics of what were going on. And
right.
I think you have to use Twitter for your own purposes. If you try to keep up with everything, you're done.
Right. I don't know. I feel like I maybe am following enough people on Twitter now. Like, I don't know that
900 is enough.
Right. Like, the ones that I'm following will retweet anything that I really need to know that the other million Twitter users are saying.
Somebody used this metaphor of evangelism as journalism at one point. I can't remember where I read it. But the idea that you're actually, you know, in ministry, you're actually sharing news of things that are actually happening and that have significance. I mean, is that something that you thought about being in broadcast radio and being in ministry, like these things are similar in some way, or do they still seem like kind of divergent?
I think the best journalism tells a story, and I think the best preaching tells a story. So to that extent, I think they have that in common. I think that is the downfall of the way Twitter brings us news, I think. I don't know that it always tells us a story. Sometimes it just tells us whatever's in front of the speaker at the moment that they're saying it, which
right.
which may not contribute meaningfully to the narrative arc of what's happening. There's a reason we have editors in journalism, and that's probably what's appealing to Twitter about Twitter to some people is that there isn't an editor. But you know, in the same way, I think. Yes, I think ministry, the Christian ministry is about a story. The gospel is a narrative. Preaching is effective when it takes the listener on a journey from one place to another, when it has a starting place and a middle and some revelation and a way to go forward. And so, yes, I think that the best journalism does that too.
So do you prefer, when you're doing the public radio, when you're in that role, do you prefer dealing with the religion stuff, or do you prefer it when you're just being asked to facilitate conversation about public issues or general interest stuff?
You know, I think I gravitate toward the religion stories because I feel like I'm on steadier ground. I feel like I know what I'm talking about more. I don't know if I'd say I prefer it. I love the variety, but I was just talking with the content strategy director at the station last week, and she was expressing pretty clearly that she doesn't want me to get pigeonholed into journalism. I mean, into religion stuff.
Oh, really? Did that surprise you?
No, it didn't. But it did. It was a good reminder to me that that could easily be the way I go if I. When I was doing it very, very part time, and I guess I still am, I felt like I had to convince them that I could bring something that wasn't otherwise represented at the station. You know.
Yeah.
So religion is the direction I went. Now that I'm a little more established there, I take that as an affirmation that they don't want me to just stay with that one thing. But I love the variety. I love covering politics. That's what I really thought I was going to do when I was in college. I'll still have a special place in my heart for religion news, which by the way is at the heart of a lot of news stories right now. I mean, you are covering religion if you're covering the Middle East, if you're covering conversations about terrorism in many places, even some domestic stories that seem like they're just all about politics get into religious issues. I think every reporter has to be a religion reporter to some extent these days.
Right, this whole thing going on with that Indiana law that got passed a couple weeks ago and other laws like it, some understanding the basics of Christianity in America would help, right?
It would, and it would make for a lot better coverage than we've seen if a reporter had the knowledge of the Christian landscape in America, not to simply assume that one party advocating for something like Indiana's Religious Freedom Restoration Act was speaking for the quote-unquote Christian perspective.
Yeah, because that still happens all the time.
It does. Or even if it's not lifted up as the Christian perspective, there are certainly more more representatives lifted up out of a tradition that is anti-gay than out of the many Christian traditions that are pretty vehemently working against that kind of legislation.
So who does that the best, do you think? Like, do you have a writer or a publication who you think knows the most about religion and reports on those things better than their peers?
There's a lot of great journalism reporting going on in America right now. I mean, some of the folks who I think are excellent would be someone like Kathy Grossman at USA Today, and I think she writes for CNN as well. Religion News Service has excellent reporters. Actually, Kathy Grossman may be writing for them now.
Really?
Lori Goodstein at New York Times is obviously one of the best reporters out there. Peter Smith, who now is at the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, he used to be at Louisville Courier-Journal, he is just an outstanding reporter. The Huffington Post has great religion coverage. Paul Rauschenbusch is the editor, and Jawid Kalim is another one of the editors. They really put together, I mean, on a daily basis, remarkable reporting and cover the breadth of religion, not just Christian stuff. And I'm sure I'm leaving out good folks.
Right.
It's a pretty interesting landscape right now, and those who specialize in religion coverage. They've picked a good time to do that.
And I was just gonna say it. For a while, I thought that the religion as a news subject, all of its own was going away. Like I thought that's gonna lose popularity. But it seems now to be more important than ever. Like something like the Religious News Service kind of baffles me that still exists.
Yeah, I mean, and they do a great job. Kevin Ekstrom, Daniel Burke. The problem is that newspapers are going away. I mean, and the money to support reporters, including sort of this traditional beat reporter model, is going away.
Right.
And that's why you quite understandably would think that religion reporters are not long for this world. But I think you just have to find new ways of covering it, which is true of all journalism, really.
Right, public radio is enduring the same kind of loss of resources to pay reporters, right?
I mean, public radio is in a different category of problems in that they have always had to raise their money, and they depend partially on government funding, but that's a tiny percentage of what they depend on. But that percentage is itself in jeopardy.
Yeah.
You know, and then of course, all charitable organizations are having to reach out for new contributions, including the one I serve, the Covenant Network of Presbyterians. So.
Well, when you started this radio stuff, you were in a congregation, and we've talked a little bit about the importance of being a public figure and being immersed in another context while you're in a congregation and how that helped you as a pastor, but how it also was good for the radio. You're not in a congregation anymore. You're serving a national church-based organization. What's the benefit, if any, to doing this radio work while also being a professional, being in ministry in this other way?
Well, I think some of the benefit is the same. It connects me to real people in the real world outside of the church context. But I guess the other benefit is just very personal. I mean, am I allowed to say that?
Yeah, of course.
I like doing it. It keeps me interested in my job, to know that my job isn't the only thing I have going on. I mean, my full-time job.
Right.
I get very focused on the work of the Covenant Network. Sometimes it's very intense. There's a lot of travel involved. So it's nice to have something else that is still meaningful. It's not just sitting on a beach reading a novel, but it's different. It's of a totally different character than the work I do with the Covenant Network.
And you're actually having to make something in this other arena. It's not like you can just read a book or read the newspaper and quote unquote, you know, educate yourself about it. You've taken on a role that requires you to speak about it over the airwaves.
Right. You'll know if I'm not doing a good job. A lot of people will know all at once.
But is there some value in that? I mean, I that's kind of a disingenuous way to ask that, because I think that there is. But do you think that there's value in having to put it out there for public consumption and public criticism instead of just sort of being able to sit by yourself and get it all straightened out in your own head first before you say anything?
Yeah, a lot like a sermon, right?
I mean,
you know, that's one of the things. I mean, I'm kind of a rarity at the station in that I do most of what I do live. Very little of what I do is recorded or edited. You have to prepare, but then once you're in the moment, there you are. And I think that's very exciting, actually. I'm not sure I would enjoy the other as much.
Right. It's exciting because who knows what could happen, right?
Right. things do happen.
Like what?
You know, things happen. People say things on the air that are funny. Questions go astray. I mean, one of the things that happens is that there's technical problems. And this happens on any radio show where the caller isn't there when you go to them. the guest who you just introduced and said hello has suddenly disappeared. And there you are with live air and needing to fill it. Actually, that's kind of the part I love about the live shows, to be honest, is you feel a little like, an air traffic controller or something. You've got a computer screen that tells you the 5 phone lines and what the question is that each person wants to ask. You've got buttons that put each call on the air. You've got your headphones on and your producer can talk in your ear that only you can hear. You've got a chat window open on the computer screen where you're going back and forth with the producer about what's going to happen next. Sometimes they're sending you excerpts of emails that callers have or listeners have sent in. And it's all happening at once. And you have a real live guest sitting across from you. And so you're trying to have a conversation that sounds natural while also doing 4 or 5 other things. It's actually really fun and exciting to me, though other people have told me that would just kill them.
It sounds pretty hectic just to hear you describe it. I mean, do you feel the need to, like, look the person in the eye whenever you ask them a question, or are you reading off the screen and doing 3 other things at the same time? Like, do you feel the need to make them feel like you're in a face-to-face conversation with them?
When I have a live guest in the studio, I actually do feel that need. And sometimes it's not totally possible, but I feel like people don't talk to you the same way if they don't get the sense that you're paying attention to them. And even though it's radio and we should sort of suspend the whole visual piece of it, I don't think that's the way most people are if they're not radio hosts. So when my guests are there, they look at me when they're talking. And if I'm not paying attention to them, they assume they must be boring and they stop talking.
Yeah.
So actually that is really important. And the other thing is you really do need to listen to them or it's not a good interview. You know, I can't just have a prepared list of questions and rattle them off. That would be very obvious to the people on the air. So I actually do need to find ways to engage with the people I'm talking with.
So it must happen that the guest says something that's totally offline from the prepared questions that you had, or like takes the conversation in a direction that you weren't expecting, and you have to kind of go with that, right?
Yeah, of course. I mean, you definitely want to let them be authentically who they are, but you know what? I usually outline where I think the conversation is going to go.
With them, you do?
No, well, no, not usually. I mean, occasionally I might say, "Here's kind of where I see the conversation going." I don't enforce that religiously, if I may, but I do kind of think the host's job is to craft a narrative, even when it's an interview. There still is a story to tell, even if it's in a question and answer format. I mean, I think that's part of what was frustrating to me about the podcast Serial that was swept the nation last year is that, you know, spoiler alert, you know, you got to the end and you didn't have a satisfying ending.
But you knew that was going to be the way it ended.
You got that sense as you got toward the end, but and that was good journalism. Don't get me wrong. I mean, she shouldn't have made up an ending, but it wasn't a good story, you know, I think
it was investigative reporting though, right?
It was, but it didn't fully live into the genre that it was set up as, which was a story.
Right. That's even how they introduced it. One story told week by week.
Right. And it wasn't a story. It was an investigative reporting piece that quite fairly acknowledged that it didn't have all the answers.
But the interesting thing about that, to go back to this whole thing about public radio and being in the moment and live, is that with a podcast like that, it's prepared and it's produced. It's not being broadcast live, but over the period of the several weeks it was being broadcast, it was a live event that was happening in the country, so across the world, people were calling her and telling her things that she had not discovered in her year of investigation before they started to broadcast the show. That was the thing that was fascinating to me, was to see how, in some ways, the story was happening in real time as they were broadcasting it week by week.
Right, and that was the most interesting part of it to me, that it actually had the potential to go a different direction than she expected. Except that I guess I wish that I believed she had expected something more, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, why do you start telling that story if you don't know how it's going to end? I'm not sure that I know I'm in the minority on this among my friends, most of whom just thought it was fantastic. And I actually loved it. I was a regular, fully addicted listener to the show. But I think you've got to have a story to tell before you start telling the story in that context.
Well, the other thing that was really outside the format of what you're supposed to do journalistically is that the reporter was the story to a large degree. Like, Sarah Koenig was the subject of what was happening as much as Adnan Syed was, right? Like, we were all as interested in what she was going to end up thinking as we were any objective conclusion.
Yeah, and I'm okay with that. I mean, I think the first person journalist these days has been in the ascendancy for years. You know, we used to not even use first person pronouns in journalism, and now, you know, there isn't an article in any long form journalistic, you know, The Atlantic or Harper's or Grantland or anywhere that has good long form writing. They're all in first person now. It's all about the author's journey toward the conclusions of the piece.
And you think that's good?
Well, it's it's the water we swim in. I don't know if it's good or bad. I think it's mostly good, though. I mean, I think it acknowledges that that's what journalism is. It is the hermeneutic that the particular journalist brings to the reporting. There is no such thing as pure objectivity. So, you know, this way of writing at least acknowledges that, I think.
There is no such thing as pure objectivity.
Never has been. That's not original to me, I'm pretty sure.
Okay, thanks. Yeah. I've been intrigued for a long time with a kind of an analogy between journalism as an industry and a profession and the church. It has seemed to me that a lot of the things that I've read over the last 10 years about the decline of print journalism or broadcast journalism have echoes in the conversation that people have about the decline of mainline churches. And that thing you just said about there being no objectivity is one of the points, I think, that applies to both of them, right? Like, the mainline Protestant, quote-unquote, liberal church tradition has embraced that idea for a long time, that we don't read the Bible as a single, literal, objective account of reality. We read it in lots of different ways, and we use historical and critical tools to read it, and we own our own biases in interpreting it, right? Like, a good sermon owns those things.
Right.
Have you noticed that shift in churches as well?
Yeah, I mean, as you said, with like a sermon, like what was a good sermon two generations ago? It was, you know, the expert authority preacher unfolding the mysteries of Scripture and telling the congregation what it meant from some alleged perspective of objectivity. I don't know if that's an exact parallel, but now we understand that the preacher preaches as one without authority, as Fred Craddock said. You know, the preacher testifies to someone else's authority, but is himself or herself one of the people in the pews. And I think that's a very good parallel. And I think the church in society has to adopt that too. I mean, Christendom is dead. The church is not does not have that kind of platform to speak with authority in really almost any part of the world anymore. And we therefore have to kind of tell our story on the basis of who we are and how we're living, and people will decide whether to listen to us partly on the basis of what they see in us.
And not as an attempt to get that platform back again somehow.
No, and if that's our goal, we've probably missed the point. But also, I mean, to be all theological, I think that's, we also just sort of trust that that's how God wants to work. God works through people. God works through who we are, not through what we have in some bygone historical era imagined ourselves to be. You know, this is the body God has now. These hands, these lips, this is how God chooses to work.
So if you were behind Serial with that insight about you know, trying to tell a story, trying to do investigative journalism, acknowledging that there is no objectivity, no journalistic objectivity anymore, what would you have done? What would you have done differently about it? Like, how would you have told that story differently?
I wouldn't have told that story. I mean, if you don't know how it ends, if you don't know that there's a story here to tell, I mean, what is that?
So you need to know the ending before you begin.
Well, you have to know that there's something worth getting people all worked up about, I think. I mean, what is it otherwise? Is it just an exercise in sort of self-gratification, you know, journalistically speaking? Is it fun to get a bunch of listeners to hang on your every word because they think you're going to tell them that a convicted man should be free, and then tell them at the end, actually, don't have any idea? Like, I mean, maybe it was a fun experience, and she was fun to listen to, but just again, I journalistically, she came to the true conclusion, but I don't know if the whole exercise is worthy.
Yeah, it's interesting. There was something almost like subversive about what she was doing in the context of public radio broadcasting, because that form of storytelling that's really prevalent now. I mean, This American Life is established, and you've got things like Radio Lab and StoryCorps and things like that. The story is nicely edited together, and there is some conclusion to the story. What she did was start something that she didn't really know how it was going to end, and by the end, the convention of tying it together, it was undone. Like, there was no way to do that. I still think there was some value in that, and there's been an effect, right? Like, the guy got granted an appeal. Isn't that right?
I guess. I haven't really followed that, but I don't know. He's still in jail.
She introduced enough doubt, like in a legal sense, to make it worth it to pursue, like, legal reconsideration of it or whatever. But it's a fascinating test case. Like, people who have most people really, really loved it. But then there are people like you who have really strong opinions in the other direction. So here's my next question for you. Like, have you thought about doing a thing like this yourself, like a podcast or something that you produce yourself?
I don't know, Rocky. What are you suggesting?
I'm suggesting you're a smart guy who's got some really good skills in this stuff and would have something really valuable to add.
Well, I appreciate that. I mean, you're the one who's doing this, and maybe you need to educate me about this. But, I mean, the biggest barrier for me is time.
Sure.
Wanting to do the job that I'm called to do, and for that matter, paid to do.
And nobody questions your commitment to that job.
Yes, and do it well, and give it all the time it requires and deserves. And then the other job I've agreed to do with the radio station. And have a actual relationship and a personal life that reflects commitment as well. That's the challenge, which I'm not sure I understand how some people do a podcast in addition to a full and good life beyond that, which I know many do.
It's this tension that exists for me and for a lot of the people, almost I would say every person I've talked to on my podcast, the tension between doing the thing that you that's on your business card, right? And really wanting to do that well and with integrity, and yet also having these other things that you want to work on, but not as side projects, things that they're part of the same thing as you get paid for, right? I guess I'm fortunate to work with a colleague and to work in a context that views, my blogging and my podcasting as contributions to the church, right? So I have not heard from anybody in my congregation that doing this is taking away from that other work. Maybe they just haven't said it to me. I don't know.
Yes, I've been hearing from them. Let me share a few of their thoughts.
Yeah, please do. Like you would share an email on a radio program.
Right. This from Karen in Claremont, California. Why are you not in your office right now?
We have a meeting right now. Where are you? But I think that tension is going to define the nature of ministry work into the future. The tension between a ministry job and ministry projects that are really valuable but aren't your job.
Right, and you think that's a good thing, right?
I do. I think it's a source of creativity and a source. It can be a source of innovation and doing new things, because I think there's a lot of really valuable stuff that people are doing or can be doing that is not in anybody's job description, and it's worth the energy and the time to just go start to do that thing rather than reworking the job description. You know what I mean?
Yeah. You know what I was just thinking about? I was thinking about the old language of the terms of call, which I think some people still use, or maybe they all still use it, that says, let's see, we the congregation of such and such a church, in order that you may be free of all worldly care and avocation, do hereby commit to pay you the following, when they sign your terms of call.
Are you reading that, or do you have it committed to memory?
No, that's from memory, so it's probably wrong.
But that is awesome.
The terms of call are not compensation for your job. They are paying you to be so that you don't have to work. They're paying you so you can be on this pastoral journey with them. And I think we've sort of all sort of wink and nod at that and say, well, that's quaint, but really we want to be treated like professionals, and so we do want to talk about compensation, and we want to make sure we have benefits lined up and so on and so forth, and I'm all for that. But maybe this change you're talking about, you know, shed some light on where that impetus came from. to say, you know, here's your work and here's your pastoral call, and the only reason we're giving you money to fulfill your calling is because we know it would be too hard to work and do this.
Right.
But is it maybe true that we need to be doing the work to have something to say or offer as part of our pastoral call? I don't know. Reflects a change.
That sounds like what you experienced when you started working at the radio station.
Yeah, it does. And I've said this. I don't think this would be hurtful to anyone in the congregation I served, which I loved, by the way, as you know. I would not have stayed at the church as much as I loved it. I would not have stayed there for 13 years if I was not doing some other things like the radio station. Part of what sustained me in feeling like that was still life-giving and new and challenging and all of that was being able to say on certain days of the week or parts of the day, I am doing something different.
And I'm sure that's still true for you, even though you're not in a congregation.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is. I have a variety of things, in service to the church and in work with the radio station that I think are life-giving outside of my one full-time vocational job.
So if you were going to start a podcast or some production of your own, what would it be about? Like what's the one thing that you think is interesting and needs to be talked about or reported on that's not being?
Parliamentary procedure.
I'm pretty sure there are some YouTube channels about Robert's Rules of Order.
Are there? I need those addresses now.
No, there are, because when I needed some pointers, I looked something up on YouTube and it just got flooded with results.
You're serious?
Totally serious.
Do you think that's a full-time job for anyone?
YouTube is not a full-time job for anyone, Brian.
All right. That's a great question. I mean, I'm pretty intrigued with the intersection of faith and public life, or politics, or civic affairs. I suppose a lot of people are, but I think that would be something I'm pretty interested in. I don't know.
So there's not like a pressing, burning thing that you would just love to do a show about or to do a podcast about, or
is that the problem? Maybe that I enjoy doing this very much. I would hope I have something meaningful to offer, but I don't have a burning passion about one particular topic that would be the only thing I would want to do a show on.
Maybe it doesn't have to be a burning passion. Maybe it just has to be like a curiosity.
Like, how did you, like, you're doing a podcast where you basically talk with people you find interesting.
Not the people. I mean, I do find them all interesting, but
present company accepted.
Yeah. No. The people I'm talking to are all doing something. They're all people who are in ministry who are doing something either outside of their congregational work or some personal pursuit that I find really interesting. And I'm interested in talking to them about why they're doing it, how they got interested in it, what's the relationship between their vocation and this. Maybe this podcast is a way for me to kind of work out some of the questions I have about my interest in these other things, right? I want to talk to other people who are doing similar kinds of projects and find out how they're holding the two together. Maybe it just needs to be something as simple as that, like something that you're curious about and you produce something as a way of working it out.
I don't know. I mean, one of the things that intrigues me about even this question of how do you decide what to talk about is to think about all of the places where I have not been the one to decide that. You know, when I was a pastor, I feel like one of my skills was sort of working with a group of people, the session of the church, sort of cultivating a sense of their mission and their vision, not trying to insert my own, but calling that forth from them. So is this a case of my sort of wanting to work toward what to talk about, but not having that clear sense on my own? I don't know. I'm just thinking out loud.
No, it's that is, I find that to be a really, really significant component of what I think what's going to be next for people like us who are in ministry, is that the training and the framework for how to be a pastor is, yeah, you're helping to lead a community of people and helping them to discern what they're called to be and do right now. And it can't be about you, right?
Right.
There's a certain degree of hubris required to say, but this other thing is about me. Like, it's what I'm interested in. It's what I'm curious about. And that's going to be the agenda. And that's okay. I think for a long time, I just thought that wasn't okay. And I've gotten to the point where the things that I'm interested in listening to, the things that I want to watch and people who I want to hear, that's what they're doing. And it's totally okay because I'm kind of fascinated by it. And they're not waiting around for permission from some other quarter to do it. That's kind of one of the themes, I think, is that you don't have to wait around for permission. The tools are there. Nobody's stopping you. And it's, you know, there's people out there who will benefit from it if you'll just do it, even if it's not perfect when you start.
I mean, one of the things that I'm pretty interested in these days, and that actually does overlap pretty significantly with my professional life at the Covenant Network, is what will the future of the church look like? Which, you know, you are offering several answers to that question, even in just the way you're asking the questions.
That's very meta.
I mean, obviously, we've passed in the Presbyterian Church, the one that we serve there, we've passed through this season of discernment. We've asked a lot of hard questions. We've had these hard conversations. I don't know that we are through all of the debates and the votes on, you know, every controversial issue, but it feels to me like we're at the end of a season of a certain kind of turmoil, right? On issues like ordination and marriage. Yeah. I think, you know, we'll probably continue to have some debates on other social witness policy stuff, but mostly it feels like the next phase of our life is figuring out what it means to be church together with the folks who are still here, which is a more inclusive church with regard to sexual orientation and gender identity, which is a more polarized church in some ways in terms of theological diversity. It's a smaller church, which is not so much the result of our divisions, though it is sometimes portrayed that way. It's more the result of people dying or kids growing up and not staying in the church. Mm-hmm. The new church is different, and I'm really interested in exploring what that church is going to look like. And, you know, that's a theological question. It's a sociological question. It's a demographic question. You know, I am really interested in asking questions about what it means to be a church together with these sharp lines of disagreement, if we can actually all agree that's okay, that it's okay for us to disagree. But then what? Do we keep talking about it, or do we just say we're not going to talk about those things? If we do talk about it, how do we keep people from getting angry and wanting to leave? If we decide only to talk about it at certain times or in certain ways, you know, how can we do that most faithfully? You know, what do we do together? Is it mission work? Is it worship? How do you make those occasions happen? You know, theologically, what is the church? Is it a particular assembly of people? Is it characterized by certain kinds of conversations and not others? Those are really interesting questions to me that I think someone has to be talking about in the church in the coming years.
And I think you're a great person to do that because, and this goes back to your comment earlier about objectivity, I think an old assumption would be that if you're going to do that, you can't have a vested interest in the outcome.
Right. You have to be totally neutral.
And you're clearly not. I mean, your job is to work for it to be a certain way, to be inclusive. And I think that gives you a great vantage point from which to tell that story and to you know, investigate what the church is actually going to look like. I mean, you're doing these things with you know, your counterpart on the other side of the ideological spectrum, where you guys go places publicly and kind of model how to be in conversation about these things about which there are these really sharp disagreements, right?
Right.
I think that's a fascinating story to tell in its own right.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that work, which I've done with Paul Detterman of the fellowship community, is some of the most rewarding work I've done in my job. Not just because, you know, it's been good to get to know him and be friends and sort of learn from each other, but because of the reactions people have to it, which have genuinely been shock that people who disagree strongly can still be friends, can still model what we old-fashionedly call mutual forbearance. That has just genuinely been a surprise to people. And it's also, I think, you know, taken the edge off some of the debates, some of the votes that have been, you know, they've gone on to be cast in those presbyteries we have visited. But yeah, it has demonstrated to me that there's a real need for these conversations about what it means to be church.
Yeah, and I think podcasts and broadcast, I mean, the tools that we have to do digital communication to reach a really wide audience, but also to reach an interested, dedicated audience, those tools are so widespread and relatively easy to use that what's the harm in trying something, you know?
Right.
If you can find the time. And I mean, that time concern is very real. All right. Well, I've taken up more of your time than I've taken up anybody else's, but it's because I could talk to you all afternoon.
And we've done that, actually.
We have done that, yeah. Not always on, you know, in a live broadcast. But I have one thing I want to ask you to do for me before we finish.
Okay.
Landon was very generous in that he produced a bit of introduction music for me for my podcast, and the audio editing tools I'm using are not sophisticated enough yet to play two tracks at once, so I haven't been able to use it. But what I could use is a really good...
You want me to compose my own theme music for you to use?
Please, no. Please don't do that. You could do this right here and now. A lead-in, an introduction. I don't know what the parlance is in public radio speak. You know, introduction of my podcast, the sort of you're listening to da-da-da-da-da in, you know, from a bona fide public radio figure like yourself. That would be really valuable, and I could just cut it and edit it and put it at the beginning.
Well, I mean, normally you as the host would be the one recording that, you know.
But this isn't normal.
I see. So what would you like me to say?
Just tell people that they're listening to the Yo Rocco podcast, and you can embellish it however you want to.
Okay. Let's see here. Well, gosh, how do I embellish
it? You could even introduce it the way that you would on the air to say that this is Brian Ellison from KCUR. You could even do that.
Okay, so this is Brian Ellison of KCUR and the Covenant Network of Presbyterians. You're listening to the Yo Rocco podcast with Rocky Suppinger. Stay tuned.
That was awesome. Okay, that's going to be the introduction of the podcast.
I'm thrilled that I can be of service.
In more ways than you know.
It's always a pleasure.